Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Duher and Tom Breeze. Episode 2, Community-Focused Schools with Dr. Jan Hyten.
Welcome back to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching. We have a special guest, a colleague from the School of Education and Social Policy here at Cardiff Met, Dr. Jan Hyten. Welcome to the podcast. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Good to be here.
Enjoying life. Absolutely. You're stuck in here now because the door handle broke just before we started recording.
We sealed you in.
Yeah, you're stuck until you tell us some interesting things
help,
about...
Somebody go for help.
It's a soundproof glass, Jan. It's not going to work.
Is anybody listening? Help!
Our topic today is community-focused schools, which we mentioned obliquely in a previous episode with Professor David Egan, but we never really dug into it in that episode, and we know you're the expert on that. But before we dig into the joys of community-focused schools, you better tell us a little bit about yourself and how you found yourself working in Cardiff Met, sealed in a podcast studio, and an expert on community-focused schools. So tell us a bit about the Jan Hyten career trajectory.
Okay, well, I'll try and give you a shortened version. I started off working in the voluntary and community sector in various roles, which I won't go into. And then I did a return to education to do a master's in housing studies and got the bug for research. So I then started becoming more interested in the education of housing professionals, which took me to UWIC as it was then, now Cardiff Met, to be a programme director on the housing studies programmes there. But the education bug had well and truly bitten me, and I was itchy to do more on the education side of things. So I started my doctorate looking at an education-related topic up in Edinburgh. And at the first opportunity, I jumped ship and went to what used to be called the School of Lifelong Learning to work on community education programmes, and from there evolved into working on the MA education programmes.
Well, there we go. You learned some things about your colleagues you didn't know when you asked this question.
So you're here to talk to us about community-focused schools, which, for someone who didn't know too much about this, reading that title, it sounds a little bit like a service, but that's far from what it is. So perhaps you could just tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, I agree that the title is a little bit unhelpful, really, in terms of what community-focused schools actually is. It's an ethos. It's a way of working. The Welsh Government have an agenda of wanting to implement community-focused schools across all schools in Wales, and it's a concept that's known simply as community schools in the United States, and probably a version of that in Scandinavia, where the practice is somewhat more developed, but in a different sort of context. And it's basically a way of increasing partnerships, developing partnerships, strengthening partnerships where they already exist between schools and other agencies, either within the local authority or perhaps in the voluntary or community sector, and just by way of collaborating and working in a multi-agency sort of way in order to answer perceived needs of children, young people and their families. So it's a range of methodologies, really, that blend together. So it's kind of like a combination of community development and education, really, but the title doesn't help. It's often misunderstood, and I do wonder sometimes whether maybe where a local authority is seeking to implement the ethos, as I'll call it, of community-focused schools, the way of working, the methodology of community-focused schools, it might be a good idea to give it another sort of title that's locally known, understood and recognised by all professionals.
And something that struck me when I was prepping for this, some of the things that you sent out to us, was that you heard about, I think you work as a governor, have worked as a governor, and I think you were reading about a community-focused school, and you sort of thought, or your reflection was, well, this just sounds like a really great school. And obviously we're not naming any names of schools here. We're not sort of singling them out. But how would one be able to tell? What would be the sort of on the ground hallmarks of this methodology in practice if you were, you know, in a community focused school?
Well, that's a really good question, and one that I sometimes smile about in a way, because when I was given the brief from the Welsh Government to work on implementing community-focused schools, and I read what a community-focused school is, and I'll just give you a few pointers there. It's about building a strong partnership with families, responding to the needs of the community where the school is located, and collaborating effectively with other services. And I thought, well, hang on a minute, isn't that just a school? We're not describing something special here. I thought all schools would operate in that way. But once I got out into the field and started looking more broadly at the work of schools, obviously beyond the schools I was already familiar with, I came to realise that maybe some schools are perhaps still on a journey towards reaching that kind of practice. But and because I come from a community development, voluntary sector background myself before I came to education, I guess I've got, I'm more sensitised to the idea of the importance of community, working with community and incorporating the voices of children, young people, parents, other family members, other people in the community. That to me was the bread and butter of community work, community development work. And it hadn't really occurred to me that perhaps that wasn't fully implemented within a school context. But each school would have their own way of, or each, maybe each local authority would have their own way of developing into a community-focused school. So the way in which you would recognise it might be that for some schools, they might be going for something that, if it works for them, maybe co-location of services. So perhaps having services for children and families actually offered on site at the school. Or it might mean that you have community-focused schools, managers, community engagement officers located at the school, working out of the school with parents and liaising with community, etc. But really, each school would implement it in their own way. I mean, there is also the issue of maybe offering services and facilities within the school out to the wider community. So that may be another way of recognising a community-focused school. There are problems with that, of course, because a school may wish to offer its services out to the community. One of the issues we've picked up from some research we're undertaking at the moment is that many schools, particularly those that have not been built in recent times, who are maybe due for a new build or due for a refurb, the design means that there are safeguarding issues if you allow anyone from the public to come onto the premises. Safeguarding issues, security issues. So there are some schools that would like to do that but can't. But where I've seen new build schools or schools that are being refurbed, then in the 21st century schools kind of agenda, you are seeing schools being built with a self-contained community room. And I also know of some schools that have got something like a porter cabin or something like that located on the school site. So it encourages people from the community, it encourages parents, maybe other agencies, to come to the school, offer services from the school premises, but in a self-contained area. I suppose also when the school is closed, you might see a community-focused school offering its services out to the public, but that also has its issues. And what we've picked up in the research is that there need to be protocols in place to assist head teachers, really, in dealing with issues of who is responsible and who is accountable, A, for the health and safety, security and general running of the school's facilities out of hours. And the schools can't really afford to be paying a caretaker to remain on site after hours. So there'd always be a cost either to the school or to the community, which becomes an issue. But also, I think local authorities probably need to work with schools, with head teachers, to help them, and to governors, to help them understand the legalities of setting up agreements for other services or the general public to use school facilities. You do sometimes hear people in the community may be wishing that they could use a school's facilities, which they can see locked up, but would be really good opportunity to use them because there aren't other facilities in the community. But the solution to that really lies with getting the right protocols in place to make that work. I don't think schools are disinclined to offer their services. It's just that they need the accountability sorted out.
I was wondering about that while you were saying that. You don't have to read much of the kind of mainstream press before you come across a story about, oh, teachers are having to be social workers, teachers are having to, you know, feed children, wash their clothes, all that kind of thing. So there is the possibility then that this help that they so desperately need could actually come on site and work with them if they could just get the legalities and the protocols sorted.
It's not so much legalities in terms of co-location of services during the school day. That's more a protocol scenario and the usual issues that arise out of multi-agency working. I know that when we first started our research project into community-focused schools, we met with a group of head teachers. We were pretty much immediately post-COVID. So a lot of services had already been cut because of austerity, and they were even worse once we came back. So it was kind of like, we can't get an ed psych, we can't get a social worker, we can't get speech and language therapy. How can community-focused schools help us to do that? But of course, community-focused schools is not a service. The idea of, say, where you've got a community-focused schools manager, which many local authorities have been able to fund with assistance from the Welsh Government, that community-focused schools manager doesn't actually do things in terms of delivering services. The idea is that those managers and their teams would broker in other professionals. And then you might say, well, are you then spreading an already diminished service even more thinly? And, you know, how does that work? But the aim is that it's done in a coordinated way. So it might be that co-location of services really isn't going to work. But if a need is identified within a school, a community-focused schools manager needs to have great knowledge of facilities that are available in the community and voluntary sector, as well as other agencies, and can identify what the need is, find out how to answer that need, and find agencies that can help with that. And it might mean locating agencies together at a particular hub, which might be at a school, or it might be at another hub, maybe a social services hub or something like that. But the idea would be that all schools would be able to access that facility, and that it doesn't just have to come out of school or education department resources. It's a case of accessing what's already there. It's an asset-based model in a way, where you're looking at what the community already has. And if there are deficits within the community in terms of service provision, or basically just coming together as a community to deliver, it's really a case of looking at what can be put in place to assist with that. And of course, non-school agencies, such as voluntary organisations, do have access to funding streams that are not available to schools. So in some cases, it might be that a school needs to accept that maybe it's not a good idea for the school to attempt to deliver something, or the schools collaboratively to deliver something. Let's broker in a local voluntary organisation that we can respect and trust, and they will then be able to access funding streams. And that's very much present in the American model as well.
So let's bring it back to the young people that this hopefully going to be sort of beneficiaries of this kind of approach, and their families. And I wonder if you've got any sort of, obviously, again, you can't give us sort of specific examples, but maybe an anonymized example of where a young person could, at a particular time in their education journey, benefit from this multi-agency, community-focused schools approach, and maybe their families as well. I think you something about transition that I read.
Yeah, definitely. Transition would be a really good area to develop a multi-agency approach in the community-focused schools style. And we do have some examples, some case studies where that has worked really well. So one example would be transition from primary to secondary, where the usual transition was going on. You know, year sixes were invited to their destination school and they met staff, they met other pupils. And then sometimes the reverse would happen and secondary would come to primary, et cetera, et cetera. But maybe there was more that could be done. And certainly we've interviewed a lot of young people during the course of our research into community-focused schools. And they've told us, you know, they appreciate what's being done. And they have an excitement but a nervousness about going to the new school. And there were things they didn't know, things they would like to know, or maybe areas of concern. And of course, it's not just the young person who's transitioning from primary to secondary, it's also their family and those around them. So one particular cluster of schools in a local authority decided to use the community-focused schools approach. So the community-focused schools manager and team spoke with the head teachers to find out what was needed, where they felt that more could be done to make a more holistic transition for children and young people. But just to emphasise, it's not that the community focused schools team would deliver this, but that they would identify what the need was using their local knowledge and their networks. They would broker in various other agencies. So the youth service was brought in. Adult learning was brought in, where at transition we had already identified during a previous stage of our research that some parents may be absolutely fine supporting their child's learning at primary, but when we come to secondary, it takes on a whole different level of requirement. And there was a nervousness, or maybe parents didn't have the level or the confidence to be able to support their children once they'd gone to secondary. So adult and community learning were brought in to offer basically adult education to parents who would like it. But also family learning practitioners would come in from the local authority to help parents develop good relationships, because one of the things that happens when children transition to secondary is also that they can tend to transition away from their parents. So the idea of rocking up at school with parent dropping you off at the school gate, you know, that's just not cool anymore, is it? You want to go on the bus with your mates, you want to walk home on your own, and somehow that does result in a fracturing of the relationship between young people and their parents, which then has a knock-on effect for things maybe like attendance, etc. So holistically, that whole transition point requires a lot of input that perhaps would not be present if it wasn't for the community-focused schools methodology that brokers in all of these practitioners. So the community-focused schools team were kind of there at the start to make sure that everything set off okay. Then they would withdraw. There's always an exit strategy so that the community, so that the multi-agency working can continue. But the community-focused schools team would always be there in the background in case there were any issues about sustaining the practice or any, you know, difficulties between agencies, etc. But the important development really for the different agencies, whether they're within or outside a local authority, the important kind of mindset is that they become less territorial. There can be a need to overcome this idea, which is it's very clearly embedded within the design of local authorities. This is my team. This is my area of work. I want to protect this. And there are reasons for that, because of the way local authorities are funded, because of the way we're assessed, because of the way we're audited, and the outcomes, the number of people using our services to retain funding. You know, there is a natural tendency to want to protect your turf, as it were. But no one is asking anyone to give up what they're doing or to reduce what they're doing. It's just maybe to work differently in a more integrated and collaborative way with other agencies for the benefit of children and young people and their families.
Funny you should say that, because I was thinking, what's a polite way of asking the question to you about the fact that schools can be really quite closed shops, if you like. They tend to not like to always open out. And yet this seems like an absolute no-brainer to do this, to get these services in.
In fairness, yes, you are right that that can be the case. And sometimes schools don't recognise that they are like that, but because we don't always know how we appear to the outside world. But in fairness to schools, other agencies within and outside the local authority also have the same sort of mindset. Now, when I worked in the voluntary sector, I kind of moved into higher education before things got really bad in terms of competition for funding. But there is a huge competition for funding within the voluntary sector, and I guess between departments and local authorities, you understand why. It's built into the design, and you know something needs to happen really at a fundamental strategic and organisational design level to prevent this from happening. But we are where we are, so you do need to find ways of overcoming this. And the first thing we have done in some research that we've been undertaking is to identify the fact that it does exist and to help people to recognise that that's what the issue is. And somehow, because we're neutral, there's a team of us, we go into various different schools and organisations and people tell us how they feel about things. And that very understandable feeling about territory really comes into it. I often refer to a model that comes out of Etienne Wenger's communities of practice approach. And that part of Wenger's theory is called boundary practices. And I use this a lot because we teach a module called multi-agency working on the MA, MA in education, MA youth and community work, MA advanced youth and community practice, additional learning needs are also able to take that multi-agency module. So it's actually taught in a multi-agency way. So what I hope we're doing by using that sort of model when we teach multi-agency working and also other modules that we teach to a range of different professionals, because it's kind of our ambition to make professional practice more multi-agency when working with children, young people and families. We explain that there it's almost like the Aristotle's theory of the golden mean, where you can have, if we're talking about collaborative and multi-agency working, you can maybe have a deficit of collaborative and multi-agency working, where organisations are just kind of bumping along together, maybe in parallel or occasionally just touching to share practice, but very much in their own space, in their own territory, and not willing to collaborate. And then, if you like, the golden mean, which is where we would like to see things happening, is that your social workers, your youth workers, your community workers, your teachers, your voluntary sector workers, they all retain their own professional identity, their own professional space, their own professional ethos, values, ways of working. But occasionally, when they work on something like a community-focused schools project, they come together and they develop a shared understanding, a shared value base for that particular form of practice. But they remain as teacher, social worker, youth worker. So their professional identity and values are retained. And when you're looking at professional clinical supervision, that would be a big area of concern to talk to your supervisees or mentees about the way in which working with a collaborative value base has affected their vision of their home value base, if you like. But then Etienne Wenger also identifies something which he refers to as a hybrid practice, where somehow the resonance with the original professional practice, be it social work, teaching or whatever, youth work maybe, becomes very much minimised, and the entire focus of the professionals who are working together on a multi-agency or collaborative project becomes a new hybrid form of values, form of practice. And that can maybe affect a teacher's ability or a youth worker's ability to still embody and work to and recognise their original professional value base. So what we're looking at is that golden mean, where you are still in your territory, your professional territory. It is protected. It is still there for you to go back to. It is still there within your practice, but that you also operate collaboratively in a different form of practice. So it's certainly rather difficult, and there are various levels within organisations, within leadership, within the way organisations may be set up in terms of departmental silos sometimes, where we can maybe just try to overcome some of these difficulties or try to get organisational change. I mean, there's a PhD in there or an EdD. Surely someone could do this and we could find maybe some recommendations for a way forward.
Yeah, well, it's really useful to hear you applying the Etienne Wenger theories of community of practice to this, because it sort of gives a sort of dose of realism to what could, from the outside, seem very fluffy and, you know, well-meaningly so. You know, this idea of community and collaboration all sound really great, but as you've very clearly articulated there, it's not easy and it takes a lot of time and some very specific approaches to build that kind of either a hybrid community or that golden mean where you retain that identity. So I guess my question here is, what are the challenges of working in this way, and how do you foresee schools who are, you know, thinking about adopting this methodology of overcoming those challenges? You know, does leadership need to change? Is the hierarchical structure of a school a sufficient?
Well, leadership needs to certainly modify to accommodate the community-focused schools ethos within schools, within educational authorities, and within other organisations, like other departments in the local authority or other agencies, to include, I would say collaborative rather than distributed leadership, because what you want to do is you want to be inclusive. You want to include other agencies, other professionals, or at a minimum, a community-focused schools manager within your strategic and operational decision-making. And, you know, ideally, if we're using a community development approach, you would also want to have voices of parents, voices of young people, community voices at the table as well. So there does need to be something of a shift, which maybe relates to Tom's original point of how schools can maybe appear to be reluctant to work with others. But then I was at a seminar earlier this week, and somebody from a school context was talking about the importance. I think it was a head teacher was talking about the how that head teacher really wanted to work in a community-focused schools methodology. But it was kind of like, but we're not trained in community development, etc. That's right, you're not. And no one is asking you to give up your education professional training or to modify it or change it. What we're asking you to do is to work with people genuinely and collaboratively, share the leadership, share the decision-making with the people who do have that training, welcome them in. And, you know, that's a big cultural issue to overcome. We've been doing some work maybe with facilitating I'm going to use the word vision, but I don't mean vision as in visioning what our future is going to be, what our strategy is, but maybe thinking about what other people's vision is like when they have eyes on you as a head teacher, or you as a teacher, or you as the head of a voluntary organisation, or you as the head of social services, children's services, or whatever, just to see how you are coming across and whether you are coming across as welcoming, and what can you do about that. But there's a lot of work that needs to be done in advance here, because you can't just dive in for the reasons we're discussing here and expect all of these different professional groups who've been trained in a particular way to suddenly find it possible to become something else. They need to feel that they've been part of the decision and part of the planning for this to occur. And sometimes that gets missed out. And it doesn't really help the way in which funding is timed, and where organisations or schools may be told, you can have this funding, but you've got to achieve X, Y, and Z by this particular time. Something like what is essentially a reform in the way schools work, a and a reform in the way voluntary organisations and other local authority departments work can't just happen overnight. You've got to bring people on board and help them to understand and to sign up to and to believe in what they're doing. Otherwise, it just becomes lip service. So somebody can say in the rather sort of fluffy, tokenistic way that Emma described there, we're a community-focused school. We've got all the signs up saying we're our community-focused school. The rhetoric is there, but the reality maybe isn't there. So, you know, you can say in public, this is what we are, but then behind the scenes, we're just what we always were. It's not something that can be layered on. It's a belief system. It's a reform in the way of working, in the way of thinking about how a school operates.
That's interesting because there are some real parallels here, I think, with the world of education reform out in Wales. And we were all Etienne Wenger fanboys and girls in this room, but I certainly find that communities of practice is a lovely, fluffy term that people chuck around without realising all the kind of rigorous theory that's underneath it. Yeah. Community-focused schools, like you were saying at the start, it's a lovely term which people could chuck around without realising that it's more than just a sign on the door. We've had quite a few episodes, actually, on this podcast, which have been in danger of veering into the doom and gloom, really. We've talked about the huge poverty gap there is in Wales, the number of children in poverty now going up, ACEs going through the roof, particularly post-COVID. We've had Dr. Anne Hodgson in here talking about that. It sounds like there might be a little bit of a danger that we can see community-focused schools as this sort of, oh, well, yeah, great solution. Let's slap some signs up on the door. Let's stick at the sort of motherhood and apple pie level, if you like, the warm words level. So as someone who's in on the inside and has seen the sort of the good, the bad and the ugly of this, how far away would you say we are? I don't know if this is a vile question to ask you, but how far away are we from having an actually hard-edged, rigorous, community-focused school approach arriving where it's needed? And if we're not there as the expert in this, what do we need to do and what do we need to avoid?
Well, I would say the Welsh Government is showing extremely strong leadership in terms of saying that it wants all schools to be community-focused schools. There is a great deal of guidance there, which we are hoping to contribute to through our research here at Cardiff Met. There's guidance as case studies. Estyn has also written some guidance and case studies on community-focused schools. So the vision and the leadership is certainly there at Welsh Government level. And I think head teachers and directors of education genuinely would like the idea of a community-focused school and maybe recognise some of the issues that I'm mentioning here, although that does take time to develop. But I think the issue is that perhaps they don't know how to move forward with this. So I think having a community-focused schools manager and team within a local authority can be helpful because that role is one that can work across boundaries, trying to embed the ethos and develop new ways of thinking, new ways of working, and genuine collaboration, maybe lessening the feeling of territorialism, which over time and with practice may become even more embedded. I think the issue is a lot of groundwork has to be done before that happens. So if you make funding available and you allow a local authority to appoint maybe a team of people, whatever they're called, who are developing this methodology for community-focused schools. If the work hasn't been done with the rest of the local authority and the other voluntary organisations with whom schools need to be working, then the whole territorialism issue, the whole I'm in my space issue can't be addressed. It almost becomes harder because something is parachuted in and people are expected, without having it explained, are expected suddenly to take this on board. A lot of work needs to happen in the background. It's a long game. It's not going to happen immediately. You know, schools are recovering still from the pandemic. We've got big attendance issues. We've got a whole host of social and economic issues that schools are dealing with. We have curriculum reform, and I can understand why schools and other local authority departments might not yet be ready for that. So I think the preparation, it's a little bit like decorating a room, isn't it? It's all in the preparation. And then when you actually put the wallpaper up or put the paint on the skirting boards, it goes on much more smoothly and you don't have too many bubbles.
And I'm curious, just to sort of round off this conversation, I think you've given some clues along the way about the role of research in this process, but what do you feel that you can bring to this process of rollout as a researcher? What is that shedding light on that wouldn't otherwise happen had researchers not been involved?
Well, I think that we are picking up where the difficulties we're describing here are actually occurring. So we're identifying where the work needs to be done and what work needs to be done, and we can facilitate that work. We have done it through the research. There is a process of facilitation, a process of awareness raising. But we also have an opportunity, I guess, to highlight where good practice is occurring. So I've mentioned that primary to secondary transition project. That's one of many examples I have where it is working as it should, or maybe it's not working quite as it should, but it's going in the right direction. So that sort of case study, which is one where it's deeply embedded. It's not just a kind of a surface level kind of arrangement, which some early pioneer projects perhaps are. You know, to see where that's happening, and to, I suppose, disseminate that, show how it's working well, but really to assist with cultural change by raising awareness of I think, explaining to people what community focused schools is not. Community focused schools is not a service provision that's going to come in and stop you youth workers from doing what you're doing or duplicate what you're doing. It's not going to stop teachers or TAs or voluntary sector counsellors of young people, domestic abuse workers, et cetera, et cetera. It's not going to stop what they're doing. It's going to ask them to do it even better by working collaboratively with others. And we just need to show how that works well and also to change minds.
And just before we move on to the homework slots, you've mentioned that lots of senior people are aware of this. They're keen to get it going. Lots of our listeners are perhaps a little bit further down the pecking order. Perhaps they haven't got the strings to pull or out the strategy to put in place. But where should they go to find out more about this if they're just interested to find out more about what it is, maybe with a view to starting a conversation at that sort of grassroots level?
About community-focused schools? Well, I mean, the guidance is available on the Welsh Government website, and I should imagine there's some stuff on the hub there as well, and we've got the guidance from ESTIN. Within our MA, if anybody's thinking of doing any modules or an entire MA, we have the multi-agency practice module, which I've just referred to. And, you know, that ethos of collaborative working alongside other professionals is obviously comes through very strongly in that module, but also all of our MA programs on the home MA here at Cardiff Met are taught as shared modules with other professionals who work with children and young people. So I would say that if you are a new teacher or someone who is planning to become a teacher, then maybe taking those sort of MA modules, or even just on your own initiative, finding out what you know about other professionals. Because I understand why every professional, whether it's a teacher or a youth worker or a social worker, is very much embedded and focused on their own professional values, their own professional area of work. But how much do we know about what other professionals do? And how do we view other professionals, and how do they view us? And I think, you know, you can do that via being co-taught on the MA. A lot of our students tell us how much, one of our modules that we offer, say autism spectrum disorder module on the MA, that's co-taught to youth workers, community development workers, and teachers or other education professionals, and they found out so much about one another and one another's practice. So the non-teachers don't operate in the classroom, but it's interesting for them to find out what goes on in the classroom so that they know what the young people they're working with experience. Likewise, teachers really only see the young people in the classroom. So from a community-focused schools perspective, how does a young person with autism have a social life? How do they associate with others? How do they operate within the family? And the other professionals in the room are able to talk about that. And it's been really, even the module leaders say that the discussion and the dialogue has taught them a lot also. So I think just finding ways of being with and understanding other professionals and, you know, not using the word other, maybe fellow professionals, something like that.
I think we've inadvertently stumbled across your something to try there, haven't we?
Which is good.
And we know that you've also done your homework and you've got two potentially interesting offerings for us. Two novels you've been reading that you wanted to tell us about.
Yes, yeah. The 2023 Booker Prize winner, Prophet Song by Paul Lynch. I finished that recently. And it's a very dark, dystopian tale of what might happen if we ended up with a tyrannical government. It's actually set in Dublin, but it could very easily be Wales or other parts of the UK. And reading about it and just the whole totalitarian regime and the way in which people lived in fear. One of the main characters was a school teacher, and he was a member of the teaching union. And because of that, and because of him protesting, etc., he kind of like got arrested and became one of the disappeared. And it was really a very sorry tale, but rather too close to home. And I guess it brought home to me the importance of community in terms of helping children and families to develop values and political awareness, because a totalitarian government might come to pass because our population is not sufficiently sensitized to political issues, maybe doesn't vote, maybe doesn't think about things like engaging in civil society and so on. So the more the community-focused schools model can maybe help us to work with children and families to feel more ownership, more agency, more politicized with a small p, to vote, to make sure that we don't end up in that sort of situation. And I also, at the end of the novel, I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but I really got a sense of why people take to small boats to escape a totalitarian regime. It taught me a huge lesson. And it may not be something that, well, it's probably not suitable for younger children. It's very complex, but beautifully crafted with lots of imagery and really rich description. It's quite challenging to read, but it might be possible to summarise the story for children and young people just so that they kind of get what might happen and maybe talk to them about what we can do to try to make sure that something like that doesn't happen within our society. I'm always reading several books at the same time. I mean, I'm also reading Che Guevara's Motorcycle Chronicles, but I'm not sure that that's for this podcast. But I'd particularly like to talk about a book called The Bookbinder of Jericho, which is Jericho in Oxford, not in the Middle East. And it's a novel that's written by someone called Pip Williams, who I'd never come across before. She's an adult author, but I sort of felt that the style in which it was written was almost more like teen fiction. And it's set in World War One in the Jericho area of Oxford. And it centres on a young woman who works in the bookbindery there. And it covers an awful lot of themes around social justice. Obviously, there is the continuing issue of town and gown in Oxford, where you've got a very big class and poverty distinctions between different parts of the population still manifesting itself, but it was very strongly manifested there. And I think we have come a long way since then. But more importantly for us, it resonates with the inequity of life chances, depending on wealth, social class, and the opportunities for education. It also incorporates the history of how Belgian soldiers came to Oxford and were nursed by local women. And interestingly, even the class distinction came to play there. So if they were middle or upper class volunteers, they were allowed to nurse the officer class. But those that were from the working classes, they weren't allowed to nurse the officers. They had to nurse the lower ranks. And it was just the acceptable way of the world in those times. So in some ways, we have moved on. But I think it may be really good to summarise to children and young people and maybe families in something like a book group to talk about those sort of issues. And there was also a neurodivergent character in the story. I don't want to say too much because I don't want to spoil it. But interestingly, because there was no health service, there were no publicly funded services, and neurodivergence wasn't even labelled in those days. It wasn't even recognised. It was just that someone was maybe a little bit different. But the way in which the working class community and the employers came together to protect that neurodivergent character, to look after her and to accept the way she was, I found rather lovely. And I think it was based on research. And I think that also could teach us a lot about how we accept others in the community, and that the community would come together to look after people who are vulnerable, not just having to use services. And again, that resonates with the ethos of community-focused schools, I would like to think.
A triple bill of something interesting from Dr. Jam there. And you're something to try about getting to know your fellow professionals that work in the community was also a really good one, and included a bit of a signpost towards the MA, of which I believe you are the glorious leader. So if somebody is interested, oh yes, if somebody is interested in finding out more about coming on that, how can they get in touch with you to find out?
Well, they better get in touch with me straight away because I might be going on voluntary severance.
Oh, Jam! Don't do it. You sealed in, remember?
Shackle her to the desk.
Yeah. Well, you could email me, Jay Hyton, that's JHUYTON, at cardiffmet.ac.uk, or obviously I'm on the internal email. I do, or have already in some cases, spoken to cohorts of students who might be moving forward. I don't think I've spoken to PGCE yet, but I have spoken to BA Primary. So my contact details are there, and your programme director or your personal tutor will have my contact details. And I'm always happy to have a chat with people about which of our range of MA programmes would be suitable for you, depending on where you are in your career trajectory, your academic confidence, etc., and whether you would be full-time or part-time. There are choices to be made, you know, and I'd like, when people contact me, it's more about making an informed choice rather than just contacting me to make an application.
Dr. Jan Hyton, thank you for sharing your knowledge, your expertise, the research you've been doing, and I'm sure we'll get you back in the future to find out more about community-focused schools.
If I haven't left on voluntary severance.
Well, indeed.
Light and clear.
We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another episode. Jan will still be attached to the desk. And we'll be back in your ears then. Bye-bye for now.
You've been listening to Emma and Tom Talk Teaching, a podcast about all things education, presented by Emma O'Doher and Tom Breeze. The special guest this episode was Dr. Jan Hyton, Programme Director of the MA Education here at Cardiff Met. We did let her out of the studio, eventually. Podcast artwork is by Beth Blandford and the music is by Cameron Stewart. Technical support by Peter Lamben and the studio manager is Adrian Rapps. We'll be back in a fortnight with something else interesting. Until then, take care and enjoy teaching.